Welcome to WRHU's One-on-One Stories. For the next 30 minutes, our host, Dr. Gregory Barroza, will talk with influential and inspirational guests. One-on-One Stories explores all areas of life and lifestyles affected by health, fitness, nutrition, medicine, mental attitude, and general well-being. Our guests discussed unique aspects of their lives and work, including current, controversial, and offbeat subjects of interest to all of us. It's One-on-One Stories with Dr. Gregory Barroza.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a bad case of loving you. No pills gonna cure my ear. I got a bad case of loving you.
Our guest today is Dr. George Kramer. He's originally a Long Island guy from West Hampton Beach. He went to Tufts Vet School, and we've known each other for over 30 years. He's specially trained at the Animal Medical Center in New York City, has board certification in internal medicine and cardiology, was perhaps the first mobile ultrasound specialist on Long Island circa 1989. He's definitely one of the best. He started his own private veterinary clinic, the Atlantic Coast Veterinary Specialists, out in Bohemia. It's a 24/7, 365 hospital with specialty services and referral, and he has a very impressive list of advanced research publications and lectures. Today he's here to discuss with us the fact that he started an UltraVet medical device company circa 2010, and he's working on some new implant. He's going to tell us about a revolutionary new invasive interventional cardiology implant device that he created, useful for helping dogs with clinical heart disease and otherwise conditions that are untreatable with conventional medicine alone. Furthermore, what's even more important is Dr. Kramer's work has much larger future implications in assisting people with similar problems if he's successful first working his problems out with dogs. So we want to welcome Dr. Kramer onto the set of One-on-One Stories here at WRHU Studio. Thanks for coming, and it's good seeing you again.
Good seeing you too, Greg.
Okay, now, we want to know why and how long has your passion for cardiology, you have a burning passion, you've done a lot of things in your career. How did that start and where did it begin and do you have any specific reason why that happened?
Well, it started way back in veterinary school at Tufts when I, you may not actually know this, but when I started in vet school, I went in with the intention of being an equine orthopedic surgeon, kind of like you. And then I found out pretty quickly that I couldn't diagnose lameness in a horse to save my life. So I figured I needed to go somewhere else. And I got interested in cardiology really through Dr. Ross, Jim Ross at Tufts, and then went off to my training at the Animal Medical Center and really went into it full speed.
Okay, that's great. I didn't know you wanted to do horses, and I'm glad you didn't crowd out my field. And I'm glad you picked cardiology.
Believe me, I wouldn't have been a threat.
And cardiology is the last thing that I claim to have any expertise in. However, what's rewarding about helping a person or a pet with a failing heart?
Well, you know, it all comes – every part of medicine is important, obviously, but the heart has a sort of a special place, and people – get really freaked out when they find out their dog or cat has heart disease, just like they would if the family member had heart disease. So being able to intervene and help them out and treat the pet is very rewarding.
Great, George. And we really appreciate all the work that you've done in that area. How many pets are out there and how many are affected by heart disease that it's even a subject for us to be listening to today?
Well, there are about 80 million dogs in the U.S. right now, and probably a little more than that number as far as cats go, and they both get heart disease. My focus for this research project has mainly been on the canine side, and of those dogs, about 8 million of them, about 10%, get degenerative valve disease, and about 2 million of those have disease severe enough where they'll go into congestive heart failure.
Wow. So 8 million dogs potentially need your assistance, and that's a large number for those of us that don't realize
it. It's a huge number, yeah.
Okay. Now, in the human heart, which is the one that I sort of know the most about, it's our critical pump. It beats about 100 times a day, moves about 5 quarts of blood per minute or 75 gallons per hour. How does your challenge with treating dogs, cats, even horses have heart disease, but various mammals of different sizes, is there a uniformity to all this, or do they vary tremendously?
Well, they vary based on size. So I do a lot of echocardiograms, which are ultrasound studies of the heart to help diagnose the heart disease, and I've scanned everything practically, reptiles, mammals. But if you stick to mammals, I've gone as small as ferrets, which have pretty, really tiny, very tiny hearts. And the largest animal I've ever echoed was a beluga whale, several beluga whales. And they're all the same. They all have 4 chambers. The main difference is the size. So the 4 chambers and 4 valves each, and pump blood to the lungs and then to the rest of the body.
Now tell me a little bit more, without going into a total educational seminar here, about the 4 chambers of the heart and the valves that you're concentrating on. How do they work? Why are they important? We hear about this, and your new business is something that I relate to in the GI of a horse with the leaky. You have leaky valves, but these valves are in our heart, and if they're leaking, we have big problems.
Very big problems, because it leads to congestive heart failure. So the blood comes back to the heart and ends up in the right atrium. There are 2 atria, 2 ventricles. So it comes into the right atrium, goes across the tricuspid valve to the right ventricle, and from there out to the lungs, picks up oxygen, and then goes to the left atrium, across the mitral valve, down into the left ventricle, and then the left ventricle is the main pumping chamber of the heart, and that pumps it out throughout the whole body. And the leaky valves that we deal with mostly are the tricuspid valve and especially the mitral valve. And that's very important in dogs. It's the most common leaky valve that we have, and similarly in people, they frequently have mitral valve disease too.
Okay. Now, the valves being so critical, in your words, why and how do these valves function? How do they normally function, and what causes them to be leaky?
Great question. So normally, as the heart fills, as blood goes from the atria into the ventricle, those 2 valves that separate on both the right and the left side, the tricuspid valve and the mitral valve, they'll swing open very freely and blood will flow into the ventricle. And then as the ventricle starts to close, these very thin leaflets snap shut and they make a nice tight closure. So it acts as a one-way valve. And the disease, degenerative mitral valve disease, causes what's called myxomatous changes to the valve. And what happens is the actual chemical composition of the valve changes. And then that, instead of being nice thin sheets of tissue, it starts to get very knobby, nodular. You know, when it closes, there are these big gaps, and sometimes the leaflets flip backwards and results in large leakages across the valves. Nobody really knows what triggers the chemical change that causes the myxomatous change. There's a lot of research in both people and dogs looking into that. But if it was you or me with that kind of valve, you'd be going in for open heart surgery to have the valve repaired or replaced if it was severely enough affected.
Okay, this gives me a thought, just as the layperson might perceive this. Like, we have backflow valves in our water system going in, so to make sure that the good water comes into our house and the bad water doesn't back up to the neighbor's house. And these valves create sort of a one-way flow of blood.
Exactly.
And the importance of that is to carry oxygenated blood, because that's what nourishes our body, right?
Right, right. And if it's not one way, then the blood starts backing up the wrong way and it backs into the lungs and you develop congestive heart failure. Fluid starts flooding your lungs and you get symptomatic for that and can die from that.
Okay. Besides the genetic predispositions people have with their hearts and heart valves, et cetera, and other diseases that are catastrophic to the valves, are dogs or cats or any other species affected by pollutants, such as people are affected by pollutants. The biggest one is voluntary cigarette smoke. Do we have anything similar in pets?
Well, there is some evidence that secondhand smoke in dogs does cause some lung disease. It may predispose them to bronchitis or asthma. I haven't seen any evidence that it results in any heart disease. In people, smoking is more associated with coronary artery disease, which luckily dogs don't really aren't that affected by. So the coronary arteries in dogs stay pretty clean.
Okay. In 2010, I discussed with you in depth some major advances in human surgery for less invasive implants to repair leaky valves. In the case, my case, it was concerning my mom and an aortic valve that needed to be replaced.
That's right.
Back in that era, there was yet just some burgeoning studies about doing heart valve replacements without open chest surgery. She needed that, and that was a great thing that you led me into. The thing that I want to bring up here is that the procedures that are now implemented, she became part of an experimental group, thanks to you, at Columbia Presbyterian in New York City, and had her aortic valve replaced. That is slightly different, that kind of a surgery, and that is actually putting a new valve in place versus what you're doing is putting a device and taking advantage of the valve that's already there, trying to make it function better, correct?
Yeah, and I got the idea from that TAVR procedure when they were still working on developing it. Before, like in the, I guess it was around 2007, 2008, I went to a couple of medical device conferences and saw some of the early work that was going on with TAVR, which is that transcatheter aortic valve replacement procedure. And I saw that, and that triggered my interest because open-heart surgery in dogs is problematic. It's very difficult to do. There are very few centers around the world that can do it. It's very labor-intensive, very expensive. And to fix all these, and also the dogs that tend to be most affected with this disease are very small breed dogs, which makes it even more challenging. So I thought that if we could do a transcatheter method similar to the way they did with TAVR, that would be a better solution for dogs. Hi, I'm Dr. George Kramer. You're listening to Dr. Greg Burroughs's One-on-One Stories on WRHU 88.7 FM, Radio Hofstra University.
What are some of the clinical signs that an owner of a dog, cat, or any other species might see themselves that might say to them, you know, my dog or my pet or my mother has a problem with their heart valve or has a problem with their heart that might be a valve related? What kind of clinical signs do we see?
Well, the most common thing is labored breathing and increased respiratory rate. So if you notice the dog has difficult time breathing, really working hard to get air into his chest, into his lungs, and also coughing, those are the two most common signs. Other things that are more nonspecific, things like exercise intolerance, and which is really one of the first signs in people. You see people that just don't have the kind of energy that they used to have. And that's a hard thing to pick up sometimes in dogs because most people just write it off as the dog's getting older and slowing down a little bit.
Okay. Now, you mentioned there are certain sizes and types of dogs. Can you be a little more specific as to the breeds or the size? And I did a little bit of reading and found out that you had performed this surgery on your own dog, which is a Labrador, which is kind of outside the norm. So can you give the public some idea about what size dog is mostly affected? And maybe there's a reason why that is. Maybe it's genetic. Give us a little bit of an idea about that.
Sure, sure. So when you think about heart disease, there are a couple of different ways to look at it, both in people and in dogs. So you can think of acquired heart disease, which means you develop it later in life. You're born with a normal heart. Or congenital heart disease, where you're born with an abnormal heart. And there are a number of different types of congenital heart disease and acquired heart disease. In dogs, the two most common kinds of acquired heart disease, the most common is degenerative valve disease, which we've been talking about. The other type is cardiomyopathy. And that we tend to see in larger breed dogs, whereas the degenerative valve disease we see, you can see it in large breed dogs, but more typically in small to medium-sized breed dogs.
Okay, and I know there's certain breeds that are specifically affected. Maybe it's got a genetic predisposition. What are those breeds?
Yeah, there's definitely a genetic predisposition. The breed that's most severely affected is the Cavalier King Charles Spaniel, which is a great breed, great dog. I even have one right now, a little puppy, 6-month-old. And they're very affected by it. And in fact, there have been some studies that said that up to 100% of the dogs will develop a murmur by the time they're 10 years of age. But other dogs, Yorkies, little terriers, poodles, those are very commonly affected too.
Okay.
Getting back to the pilot study, that was done, as you mentioned, on Labradors. And that was because we used a congenital form of heart disease, tricuspid dysplasia, which is very common in Labradors. And we did it in 3 Labradors. 2 of them actually were my dogs. And we chose that model because the dogs were larger and were going to be easier to do the procedure on.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. And also, it was your dog, so
right.
You gave yourself permission to get this experimental work done, which is how some of the greatest scientists in the world have invented things.
Right. It's like vaccinating yourself when you're...
What's the present name of this implant that you're working on?
We've developed 2 different valves, slightly different designs. One is called the Tucker valve, which was named after my dog Tucker. And the other is called the COAPT valve. And they perform the same function, but they do it through 2 different designs.
Okay. We might ask you briefly if you can just give me a very audible but visible visual type of description. How do these 2 different valves work?
So
implants for the valves.
So what they do, they both utilize the defective valve that's present in the heart, whether it's the tricuspid valve or the mitral valve. And the way they're structured, the Tucker valve, they're both on a shaft that has a little corkscrew at the bottom of the shaft. And you go down the jugular vein and you go across the valve, the affected valve, either the mitral or the tricuspid valve. And then that corkscrew screws into the bottom of the ventricle and anchors the shaft in place. The Tucker valve has a balloon then that blows up inside the ventricle on that shaft, and it'll ride up and down the shaft, and there are certain limits on it, so it limits how far it can ride up and down. And it's set so that it rides up and occludes the leaky tricuspid valve as the valve closes.
So, in other words, it sort of acts as a filler. So where there would be a hole or a deficit, it will clog that in the return of the valves to seal, so it gives them a better seal.
Right. It just fills the gap. And the being a balloon means that you can get – it's very small, so you can get it into the heart and then blow it up once it's in the heart.
And the other valve, the COAPT valve?
The COAPT valve, you can think of that, the same concept. It's on a shaft. But then think of it like a kind of an umbrella. So once it's in the shaft, the arms of the umbrella open up inside the atrium, and attached to those arms is a little skirt, like a valve skirt, that drops down into the ventricle between the defective valves, the native valves that are diseased. And it's very thin tissue, that skirt. It's actually made from submucosa from pigs that's processed, and it's thin like paper. It almost looks like onion paper, but very flexible. And that does the same thing. It plugs up the hole, the gaps that the diseased valve has.
Okay, now untreated, if we have this deteriorating valve disease, eventually that leads to some sort of congestive heart failure, and unfortunately my mom passed away from it, and recently Nancy Reagan too. Is that a fair analysis, or is there more to it?
No, that's very accurate. Congestive heart failure, the ultimate end game of congestive heart failure is death. There are a number of different medications that we use and use in people, and that can help control the signs, control the symptoms. It can extend their life to a certain degree. But in the majority of those cases, once you're in congestive heart failure, despite all the medications, ultimately you're most likely going to die of congestive heart failure. In people, the end stage at that point would be a heart transplant. And, you know, that's not done as frequently as it needs to be done.
The number I've heard thrown out for people that are diagnosed going into significant congestive heart failure is about a 5-year survival. And in that process, the muscle of the heart itself is taxed so much to at some point it just can't hold up anymore.
That's right. And the blood backs up into the lungs and into the other tissues in the body.
Okay. Now, a slightly different note, but along the same lines, you've done some surgeries where you've implanted pacemakers into animals. Now, these pacemakers were made for people, not for animals, and there might be a learning curve there and maybe not perfect. One of the biggest problems is the expense. And then on top of that, now you're into an area where you're trying to specifically design a catheter for a pet that doesn't exist in people, and there's a tremendous learning curve there. Also, there's a cost factor for making all this happen. Do you have anything to say about those two subjects?
Yeah, absolutely. I first learned to started putting pacemakers in way back during my residency at the Animal Medical Center. And then subsequent to that, started doing other interventional procedures like balloon valvuloplasties, things like that, or plugging up holes in the heart with occluders for patent ductus arteriosus, or something called a VSD, which is a hole between the ventricles. So we go down and we're going down through a catheter and deploying some type of device, which is what got me into this whole field to begin with. And I realized how important it was and what a great treatment option it was for dogs. Over the years, though, I realized that Medtronic and St. Jude's and all the big medical device companies were focused, you know, understandably on people and not so much on the veterinary market. So we would get pacemakers that were donated from Medtronic to the College of Cardiology and distributed out to the rest of the cardiologists, veterinary cardiologists around the country. We'd put them in that way. Years ago, even before my time, they would get pacemakers that were explanted out of cadavers and use those in dogs. That's not done really anymore. We use new pacemakers that are basically short-dated by the manufacturers. So they can only sell them up to the sterilization date. You can't re-sterilize them to put in people, where we can re-sterilize them to use them in dogs. So,
yeah, I think the public might get a kick out of learning that we're often like the third or fourth or fifth child in a family. We get all the hand-me-downs.
Exactly.
And we try and do the best we can with them. But what the public also doesn't know is a lot of the great advances that end up working in people originate by our intervention as veterinarians.
That's right.
We've been listening to Dr. George Kramer discuss his invention of cardiac valve implants. And next week, please tune in for part two, which he will continue his discussion telling us about the difference between animals and people in heart valve replacement and go into some of the details and challenges of bringing his invention to market.